It's our time now. The show is Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel, your host, and I appreciate you being a part of the show. And regarding that, I was just reminded by Amy that I should actually give our phone number out more often. Now, when I was doing live radio with the Crawford Network for all those years, I was always giving the number out because people are driving around or sitting listening live and they can call in. And we started doing the way we're doing now, and that's actually not so much the case, although now more and more people are listening on our app and live streaming on our – they can do that on our app, live stream on our app. Is that right? Yes. And online. And so you can call directly in, live, as it were, 855-243-9975. That's the number, 855-243-9975. And frequently there's lots of room on the lines here. So love to chat with you. And that's the number, of course, to call if you want to call in live. So if you're not listening live, but you want to call in live, just call that number on Tuesday afternoons or early evening, depending where you're at, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. That's where I'm at in L.A. on that time zone. So once again, 855-243-9975. Now, I'm looking at a picture here of a very sweet woman. She looks like she's, oh, here she is. She's 28 years old. She's nestled against the chest of her sweetheart in this nice picture, staring right at the camera in a soft, sweet fashion. Got kind of brownish, reddish hair. Her hand is on his chest like she's safe there. His arms are around her and part of her shoulder is exposed, and you see a tattoo of a tree on her shoulder. It's actually a very sweet photo of this sweet gal with beautiful blue eyes looking at the camera, or in this case, kind of the reader. And this article, the title is, I'm 28, and I'm scheduled to die in May. So this is a piece from the Free Press, and the subtitle here is, the Some Right to Die activists want everyone to have access to euthanasia, even young people with mental illness. Also, rather, are they also making suicide contagious? So that's the lead-in. There's a wonder here. Now, this is a report from Holland, which initiated the Right to Die movement legally some 20 years ago. And during that time, of course, I was on the radio then, and we talked a lot about the moral implications of the Right to Die movement, which has moved forward aggressively, not just in Holland, but in the United States as well. And I voiced very significant concerns regarding this. And the concerns really fell into two different categories. No, maybe three categories. One of them is the morality of suicide itself. Actually, now I'm thinking four categories. The morality of suicide itself, the morality of enlisting the medical profession to help you commit suicide, that's a whole nother question, all right? Because it used to be that physicians took an oath that they would do no harm. Now, of course, everybody understood what that meant back then, and that assisting a suicide would be an example of doing harm to the person. But now I can see how it could be reinterpreted, as a lot of things are, that harm has to do with the person's desire. And so if you're withholding help with a suicide, you're actually doing harm to that individual. That could be the way it's construed. But anyway, those are the first two issues. The second was, the third was a logical slippery slope problem. And the fourth was a causal slippery slope problem. Neither, by the way, are slippery slope fallacies. They are legitimate slippery slope concerns, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But I want to read this rather relatively short article to you, and Amy will include it in the show notes. But this gal's name is Zoraya Terbeek. Terbeek is her last name, apparently, a Dutch name. 28, expects to be euthanized in early May. Her plan, she said, is to be cremated. I did not want to be a burden on my partner with having to keep the grave tidy. Sweet. We have not picked an urn yet, but that will be my new house. Terbeek, who lives in a little Dutch town near the German border, once had ambitions to become a psychiatrist, but she was never able to muster the will to finish school or start a career. She said she was hobbled by her depression and autism and borderline personality disorder. By the way, there are a lot of people who are autistic that are on the spectrum, so to speak. And I just don't want you to think because somebody's on the spectrum that somehow means their lives are hobbled. This is the way people think about Down syndrome children. And if you've known any Down syndrome children, sometimes they can be a handful to care for because they're dependent for most of their life on care, usually family members. But they're among the most joyful, happy kids and people. The presumption is, of course, if you have some kind of disability, that means your life is going to be miserable. That is not a sound presumption. Just saying, in light of the language here in this piece. Continuing, now she was tired of living, despite, she said, being in love with her boyfriend, a 40-year-old IT programmer, and living in a nice house with their two cats. She recalled her psychiatrist telling her that they had tried everything and that there's, quote, nothing more we can do for you. It's never going to get any better, close quote. Now, I had to pause there in the margin when I read that line. I wrote the word sad, like this is really sad. But it wasn't sad. I didn't mean sad that she would never get any better. That is sad. But what was more sad to me, more grievous, is that the diagnosis that she'll never get any better than she is now with her depression and autism and borderline personality disorder is a reason to end one's life. And I thought, when I read that and wrote SAD in the margin, I thought, I'm really glad I'm a Christian. I'm glad that this life is not the only life there is. And even in this life, that the psychiatrist isn't the only resource that I have to live a satisfying life, mental health provision or care, because I have the Holy Spirit. I have friends with an eternal perspective that love me no matter what my liabilities might be, depression, autism, borderline personality disorder. It's sad that when someone says, whatever you're struggling with is never going to change, that someone says, okay, I don't want to live anymore. That's what's sad. And if it turns out that Christian theism is actually true, then this is tragic. Because on a certain level, there is a better life that one can have, even with those disorders never being dealt with. And this isn't the end of it. This is the beginning. It's only going to get better. This is the worst it will ever be. Anyway, I continue. At that point, she said, in other words, understanding that it was never going to get any better, that she decided to die. I was always very clear that if it doesn't get better, I can't do this anymore. As if to advertise her hopelessness, Terbeek has a tattoo of a tree of life on her upper arm, but upper left arm. That's what I was referring to in the photo, but in reverse. And she explains, where the tree of life stands for growth and new beginnings, my tree is the opposite. It is losing its leaves. It is dying. And once the tree died, the bird flew out of it. I don't see it as my soul leaving, but more as myself being freed from life. Now, I'm going to say more about this in a moment, but notice when she's making the assumption that when she dies, she is being freed from life. Well, I guess it's hard to argue with that assumption. Yes, She is being released from life, so to speak, but she sees this as a positive thing. And in order to think that this is a positive thing, you have to make certain assumptions, worldview assumptions, that better be right if you're expecting to experience freedom of some sort on the other side. Her liberation, as it were, will take place at her home, the article continues. No music, she said. I'll be going on the couch in the living room, she added. The doctor really takes her time. It's not that they walk in and say, lay down, please. Most of the time, it's first a cup of coffee to settle the nerves and create a soft atmosphere. Then she asks if I'm ready. I will take my place on the couch. She will once again ask if I'm sure, and then she will start the procedure and wish me a good journey. Or in my case, a nice nap, because I hate if people say safe journey because I'm not going anywhere, which is an interesting insight. Then the doctor will administer the sedative, followed by a drug that will stop Beek's heart. When she's dead, a euthanasia review committee will evaluate her death to ensure the doctor adhered to the due care criteria, and the Dutch government will almost certainly declare that the life of Zoraya Terbeek was lawfully ended. Now, this is sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. So she gets euthanized and she's dead, and then they're going to assess whether it was done appropriately. What if it wasn't? Well, you're not going to bring her back. You're going to, I guess, maybe prosecute the doctor who gave the sedative and the death drug. Anyway, she asked her boyfriend to be there with her to the very end. There won't be any funeral. She doesn't have much family. She doesn't think her friends will feel like going. Instead, her boyfriend will scatter her ashes in a nice spot in the woods that they have chosen together. And then she says this, I'm a little afraid of dying because it's the ultimate unknown. We don't really know what's next, or is there nothing? That's the scary part. You know, that's part of the famous soliloquy there in Hamlet, where Hamlet is reflecting on to be or not to be. That's the question. That's the issue he's talking about, is to live or die, because life is hard and maybe you should just, you know, give in and die and then you'd have rest. But, he says, what dreams may come when we shuffle off this mortal coil? That's what gives us pause. What dreams may come. And that's what she's saying here. Well, what's on the other side? We don't know, is what she's saying. Now, I think there is reason to know. And if there is reason, if what I think is the case about the afterlife, this is not a good scenario for Terbeek. I can understand why she'd be scary. She's taking a chance. She thinks she's going to be freed. She thinks that her emotional suffering will be over. I did a debate very, very early in my professional career as an apologist on this very issue at a junior college here in Southern California. And I think the accusation against my view was that it was religious. And I, you know, I'm imposing a religious view. And my basic point, and I can't remember all the language, but I do remember the point, was that both sides have to make a religious presumption. That is a presumption about the nature of the afterlife. I have an understanding of what that's like, but the person who thinks that when a person commits suicide, they are being released from their pain and their misery, they're making an assumption that whatever follows will either be nothing or better than what they're experiencing now. And what secures that confidence? If Jesus was right, then you are not releasing somebody from their misery in that circumstance if they don't know him. And if they do know him, they're probably not likely to participate in this, though tragically that does happen sometimes. It's not so much in a doctor-assisted suicide, I think, but rather in an occasion of suicide when hope runs out for somebody and that and they take their own life, even though they're Christian. It does happen. But if Jesus is right, then she's moving to a much more painful existence that will never end. She says that's the scary part. It is. And then after this human element that we see the inside of this this what's the right word here process dynamic this really trend that's happening, we see a person involved in this. Gee, this ought to give us pause, although the characterization was as nice and sweet as it possibly could be. Okay, what's going on here? And the article makes a shift. It says, Terbeek is one of a growing number of people across the West choosing to end their lives rather than live in pain. Pain that, in many cases, can be treated. And incidentally, the pain that she described was psychological pain or maybe psychological discomfort. It wasn't like you have debilitating physical pain that's just hard to live with. And by the way, if that's the case, generally there's palliative care that helps reduce the pain. Here we're talking about a different kind of thing that in the minds of this person, Terbeek, and also many others, justifies someone taking their own life. Now, the article says, typically when we think of people who are considering assisted suicide, we think of people facing terminal illness. But this new group is suffering from other syndromes, depression or anxiety exacerbated by, they say, economic uncertainty or the climate. Can you believe that? All the concern about climate change got people so depressed they want to end their lives? Maybe social media. These are all things that are expressed in this article. And a seemingly limitless array of fears and disappointments, which, I mean, what I would say is that's life. A limitless array of fears and disappointments, that's life. I mean, there's lots of good stuff too, usually balances that out, but nevertheless, it's almost as if, let me just read the list again. The new group is suffering from other syndromes, depression or anxiety exacerbated by economic uncertainty, the climate, social media, and a seemingly limitless array of fears and disappointments. Don't you see that's kind of the nature of life? And people are saying, oh, life is hard. This is, it's not super great. Okay, well then, I want out. This isn't people who are facing terminal illness. This is a new wave, is the point here. And here is Steph Groenewald, a healthcare ethicist at Theological University Kampen in the Netherlands. And he says, I'm seeing euthanasia as some sort of acceptable option brought to the table by physicians, by psychiatrists, when previously it was the ultimate last resort. I see the phenomenon, especially in people with psychiatric diseases and especially young people with psychiatric disorders, where the healthcare professional seems to give up on them more easily than before. Now, here's another statement from a different ethics professor, healthcare Theo Bohr, healthcare ethics professor at Protestant Theological University in Groningen. And he served for a decade on a euthanasia review board in the Netherlands. Now, this is a Protestant. He says, I entered the review committee in 2005, and I was there until 2014. In those years, I saw the Dutch euthanasia practice evolve from death being a last resort to death being a default option. He ultimately resigned. Bohr had in mind people like Zora Terbeek, who, critics argue, have been tacitly encouraged to kill themselves by laws that destigmatize suicide, a social media culture that glamorizes it, and a radical right to die activists who insist we should be free to kill ourselves whenever our lives are, quote unquote, complete. So there's a radical autonomy that's being promoted there. They have fallen victim in critics' eyes to a kind of suicide contagion. And see, this is what was being referred to in the subtitle here, are they also making suicide contagious? And there's been some concern, and justified, it seems to me, about the whole gender dysphoria element and the transsexual trend or wave that we've seen in the last 5 years as being really driven by something called a social contagion, which is like a fad. I mean, this came out of nowhere, especially for young women who are adolescent or teenagers. They never were on the charts here for gender dysphoria, and all of a sudden it's like the cool thing. What was it? Cutting was something like that too. I don't hear so much about it anymore. Maybe the fad changed to this. Now this writer, Rupa Subramanya, for the Free Press, is wondering, is this the new fad? Is this the new social contagion? And then he says, statistics suggest these critics have a point. In 2001, the Netherlands became the first country in the world to make euthanasia legal. Since then, the number of people who increasingly choose to die is startling. Now, that's the end of their the article here, but I have some more to add. I mentioned a little earlier that there are a number of issues in play here. One of them is the question of the morality of suicide itself. Do we have a morally justifiable right to end our own lives? Now, if you believe that God exists and that He made us, then that means we belong to Him. We don't belong to ourselves. We may be the tenants, as C.S. Lewis put it, but He's the landlord. And so our bodies are not ours in the sense that we can choose to do whatever we want with them. So that's one question, and a little bit to think about regarding that. The second one I already mentioned is the idea of, should doctors be involved in this process? I think not. I think that corrupts the medical profession, which is already now 20 or 30 years, especially since Roe and abortion on demand, has been deeply and profoundly corrupted on a moral basis. I'm not saying that every doctor is a corrupt person. I'm saying that their moral compasses have been broken with regards to life and death issues because of things like this. And there's been a steady change in perspective here. I also said that there is there are two slippery slopes in view. Now, a slippery slope, well, there are different kinds of slippery slopes, okay? And there are things called slippery slope fallacies. So if you say, once you start doing this, then this is going to happen. Well, you've got to demonstrate that there is some, in a certain sense, causal relationship between the two. If you do A, then B is going to happen. You can't just say, if you do A, then B. You've got to show that. And if you can't show that, and you're just saying, okay, you're going down the slippery slope, well, you're likely advancing a slippery slope fallacy. But there are two kinds of slippery slopes that are not fallacious. One is called a logical slippery slope. And that is when you justify some action that is arguably immoral, like taking one's own life. And then you argue for that based on a line of thinking. And the line of thinking might be something like, I'm an autonomous human being. I have a right to do whatever I want with my own life. Okay, therefore, given that line of thinking, I can take my own life because my own life is within my control to take because I'm an autonomous human being. Okay, well, once you accept that, and that is largely the justification for suicide that many people have taken, especially doctor-assisted, and that seems to sanitize it a little bit because you bring a doctor in, it makes it sound better. It sounds more legitimate. And it also isn't something you're doing on the fleur of the moment in a fit of depression or something like that, but you're actually thinking it through and you've justified your own choice by the reasons that you have and the doctor's there to help you out. And so it just sanitizes the whole enterprise, at least in the minds of some. But still, it's one taking their own life, the doctor helping them to do it. And the justification is human individual autonomy. All right, but see, if that's the justification for doctor-assisted suicide, why doesn't that same justification apply to all other kinds? Why is it, well, we'll let you kill yourself with the doctor's help if the board approves, if you're terminal, if you, you know, there's no chance that you're going to live very long and you're in a lot of pain or whatever. Because notice that they've just qualified the autonomy argument with other requirements. You have autonomy if you're about to die anyway, or if you're in pain. But see, that's not the argument that's offered. What's offered is I'm my own person. And if a person is their own person in that sense, that they can make this kind of decision, then what is the justification for putting any limits? You must have two doctors agree. You have to be terminal. Wait a minute. If I'm an autonomous self, why does that matter? So obviously, when this started, there were all kinds of safeguards that were put into place. But what I'm saying is, if you buy the logic, then the safeguards turn out to be illicit. And sooner or later, the logic is going to have its way, and it's going to start whittling away at the safeguards. And in fact, that's what's happened. This is exactly what I said was going to happen 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when this was first being discussed. This is 2001, so that's 13 years ago. But 2 years before that, we were dealing with that issue. I still have the articles that they're probably still online on our website dealing with doctor-assisted suicide. So we were pointing this out as a problem. And unfortunately, the prophetic word has come true. And not because I'm a prophet, but just because I could see the relationship of how ideas work. That's the logical slippery slope. So you agree to a certain logic to justify a certain action, but the same logic can be applied in other places just as legitimately. And so the logic slips into other things. And so now it's not just if you're terminal, but if you don't want to live anymore. And by the way, since that's the logical argument based on autonomy, why are there age limits? Do you only have autonomy if you're 21 years old? What if you're 18? What if you're 16? What if you're 12 years old? Do you lose your autonomy? Now, you might be thinking, oh, well, that's kind of an extreme application. No, it's not. Because right now, according to the Dutch Euthanasia Act, the limit for validating or affirming one's own doctor-assisted suicide is 12 years old. A 12-year-old can't decide in Holland to end their own life. And I have in front of me right now an abstract from the Journal of Medical Ethics that looks at the age limit for euthanasia requests in the Netherlands and does an analysis. I'm reading the abstract. In other words, this is just the summary. And the background first sentence here, The Dutch Euthanasia Act applies to patients 12 years and older, which makes euthanasia for minors younger than 12 legally impossible. The issue under discussion specifically regards the capacity of minors to request euthanasia. Now, they're not talking about 12-year-old minors. They're talking about minors younger than 12 years old, because 12 is right now the basement limit on the age. They're looking at moving it lower. That's the question of this analysis. And here's their conclusion. This study shows that the age limit of 12 years in the Dutch Euthanasia Act is too strong, according to pediatric experts. Did you catch that? That's too limiting. And then they continue, letting go of the age limit and lowering the age limit combined with adequate capacity assessment for minors younger than 12 are options that should be discussed further. In other words, these people think that the age limit is not low enough. In another part of the abstract, it says the experts agreed that five criteria for capacity found in previous literature study are all important. They agreed that some children between the ages of 9 and 11 could meet all the criteria. Now, who made these criteria? I don't know what they are. But basically, their criteria to say, okay, well, if you meet these criteria, you are justified and have a right to end your own life. and we'll get a doctor to help you. Experts agreed, watch this one, that the parent's opinion is relevant and should always be taken into account, but it need not be decisive. Now, all that can mean, there's only one way to understand, and it need not be decisive. And that is, if the 9-year-old wants to take his or her own life and the parents object, that need not be decisive. What you may end up doing is honoring the 9-year-old's request to die. I don't know. I'm trying to think, when I was 9 years old, did I ever feel like I want to die? I mean, there were things I was unhappy about, but I don't think I ever thought that. But, okay, this is what's going on. Okay, so you have this logical slippery slope, and frankly, this is exactly the kind of thing one would expect to take place once you put this logic of human autonomy in place regarding suicide. Then what is the justification, if human autonomy is the real issue, for making any kind of limits, even age limits of any kind, putting those limits on it? There, it seems to me any attempt at putting any kind of limit on it would be a violation of human autonomy, which is the main reason that the government should allow doctor-assisted suicide. So this is what you're going to have, slip, 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 slip. In the last 20 years, 23 years, that's exactly what we've seen happen, certainly in the Netherlands. But also in the States. But there's another slippery slope here, and that's a causal slippery slope. And a causal slippery slope is when there is an action that you might take that in itself is morally benign, but the action leads clearly to other actions. They encourage other actions, or they abet other actions that are immoral. And so the immorality of the actions that are caused by the moral action slips into the morality of the initial action. Okay, so let me show you how it plays out here. Let's just say we agree that voluntary euthanasia is okay for the reasons people give, human autonomy. That's voluntary. My concern, and I raised this over 20 years ago, and so did a lot of other people, is that once we give people the right to die, we are making a statement about human value. And that statement about human value is going to have ramifications in other ways. By the way, there's a little bit of a logical slippery slope in play here. But the causal one is, even if we allow a legitimate voluntary euthanasia, there are going to be circumstances that follow, or that result, of non-voluntary euthanasia. Okay, what's non-voluntary euthanasia? Voluntary is when somebody says, I want to die. Non-voluntary is when someone can't say. They may be in a coma or whatever their condition, they are not in a position to say aye or nay. And what ends up happening to a culture that has a medical profession, a medical establishment that has gotten used to the idea of euthanasia in general, now they start making decisions for those people who can't make a decision for themselves. Now, we have advanced directives in this country that are meant to cover those bases, but they don't always work that way. And so what ends up happening is then people feel justified in taking the life of those people, euthanizing those people who cannot decide for themselves. So it goes from voluntary, which may be morally justified. I mean, in this characterization of a causal slippery slope, I'm just stipulating, okay, voluntary is okay, but what it causes, it leads to, is non-voluntary, which that ain't okay. And there's another step, though, another slip. It goes from voluntary to non-voluntary to involuntary. That is, these are people who are saying, I don't want to die. And the medical establishment is saying, you're going out anyway. You're a burden on us. You're costly. Look at what you're doing to your family. There are other people that are more deserving of the care we're giving you. You're too sick. This is it. And so there's all kinds of pressure then to go along with the euthanasia, but it is de facto involuntary. And so even if voluntary euthanasia is morally good, there is a causal slippery slope. It leads naturally to non-voluntary euthanasia and involuntary euthanasia. And this was what I said 25 years ago, and a lot of other people did as well. And folks said, no, that's never going to happen. And it's happened. It certainly has happened in Holland. And I've heard stories here, too, where people are just, you know, pressured. In any event, that's the state of affairs we're facing. And all the more reason, incidentally, for us to be mindful of the suicide problem and to do what we can for those people who are contemplating suicide. Now, we have our final reality of the season coming up in a few days. And you can still sign up for that at realityapologetics.com. It's going to be in Georgia, Augusta, Georgia, this weekend, April 19 and 20. We still have more room for people. Just go there and sign up. Love to see you there. But John Noyes, every single reality that we've had for like, what, the last 4 or 5 years, he does a breakout on suicide, and the rooms are packed. And sometimes after he's done talking, he's talking with students all the way through lunch, all the way through the next plenary session until the second breakout on suicide starts and people start pouring into the room again. That's how big of a problem it is with Christian folk, or at least people who are involved in Christian groups or larger Christian community who end up at realities. And this is one of the reasons that this reality is so important, because we're talking about identity. Who says who you are? God or man? That's the question. Your maker or other human beings? Who gets to say who you are? And we try to put this in the right perspective, because if we are the ones who get to say who we are, this leads to all kinds of problems, because that's not consistent with reality. That's why this particular reality is so important to attend, and this is the last one we have. Incidentally, if you go to realityapologetics.com and you can't go to this one or any others, we actually live stream the Dallas one, and you can subscribe to that and benefit from this particular one, Man or Maker, Who Says Who You Are. But we'll continue doing that with John, because he does such a great job saving lives, literally. People come up to him afterwards or years later and say, John, you saved my life. Well, John has done an STRU course on suicide, what every Christian needs to know, and it's available at str.org. So that's another place where you can get more information that will help you, not just if this is something that is troubling you and you're contemplating this because your hope is running out, then you need to hear from John. Or if you have family members like that, you need to hear from John. So I just recommend that to you. All right, let's take a break, and I'll come back with calls. Or maybe open my calls here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, John, and I, Robbie Lashua, are available both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule us today. We can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues in science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read our bios and learn more about the topics we cover, visit str.org. Then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, John, or me, Robbie, today.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking, and we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic, and subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
All right, the number here, again, if you'd like to call in live with me, 855-243-9975. I'm going to try to give that number more frequently. I got out of the habit of doing it since we weren't running kind of a live broadcast, but now with folks listening to live streaming, I want to kick that out there. So if you're listening and want to call me with a question, comment, interact with me, give me a piece of your mind, and I'll do my best to give you a piece of mine, then the number's 855-243-9975. Okay. And right now I'm going to go to some open mic calls, and that's when you can call in, and you can't call when I'm here, but you can essentially call in on a phone line or do it online on our str.org website and then voice your question there, and I can take it on a show. What? Oh, well, yeah, you can call live right now on that number. I said that. I think I did. Okay. 855-243-9975. But if you want to leave a open mic call for us, just go to str.org to the homepage, and under podcast where it says live broadcast, you'll see the feature there that will make that possible. So let's talk, let's hear from Joy Miles here. Has a question about Proverbs, I think. And what's on your mind, Joy?
This is Joy from the Sand Hills of Nebraska. And I have a question. Our Bible study's been studying a book about Mormons and how to reach Mormons for Christ, talking a lot about, in one chapter, about the feelings that Mormons base their faith off of. Mm-hmm. My question is, when we looked up different verses, feelings seem to really coincide with the word heart in the Bible. And one place, in many places actually, it says that the heart is deceitful and the heart is wicked. And then there are other places where it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. And there are several other verses like that, and I'm sure you guys know those even better than me. How do you trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding? But when our hearts are wicked, mm-hmm. It seems like there's kind of a conflict there to me, and maybe I'm just not getting it, but thank you very much for your ministry. You have been such a blessing, such a blessing. God bless you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Joy. And I think your observation is a legitimate one, that there is a liability. The idea of total depravity, by the way, and you might hear this term tossed around in certain theological circles, is not that human beings are as bad as they can get, but that rather every area of being human is influenced by the fall. So our thinking is influenced by the fall. Our emotions are influenced by the fall. Our acts of will and our intentions are all influenced by the fall. So in a certain sense, every aspect of being human has suffered some corruption. In other words, the total areas of human behavior have been influenced, not that depravity is expressed in its uttermost in every area, okay? So that means when it comes to our hearts, that even our hearts are fallen. And so we need to be aware of our hearts being fallen. Now, let me pause for a second and give you an example of what I'm talking about. There is a thing called... it's a kind of bias. It's called confirmational bias. Amy's jumping for the mic there to give me help me out. Confirmational bias. And that is where you have a tendency to favor your own view and look for evidence that confirms your view, and not adequately take into consideration the evidence contrary to your view. So it's confirmational bias. Now, what is the value of knowing that that we are subject to confirmational bias? Well, it's so we can be on a lookout about it for it. We can be aware that we tend to confirm our own views. And since we are aware of that, we're going to be careful and maybe look a little further next time to make sure that our views are properly justified and we're not ignoring evidence to the contrary. All right. Now, I think this concept or this way of dealing with a liability is applicable here. If we know our hearts are deceitful and desperately wicked, okay, and that's Jeremiah 17, I think, verse 9. And if we know it, they're deceitful, then we are going to maybe be more careful so that we're not deceived by our hearts, whatever that is. I'm going to talk about heart in just a moment. But notice that by telling us that our hearts are that way, then it alerts us to be cautious. It's like in Proverbs, there is a proverb that's repeated twice. It's exactly the same in both cases. And that proverb is, there is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Now, what's the point of saying that unless a person who hears that can be instructed to be more careful with the ways he thinks is right to make sure that they don't lead to death? And the fact that it's repeated twice, the exact proverb in different chapters, indicates that, you know, this is kind of important. There are a number of things that are repeated more than once. Sometimes almost the same words, and other times the concepts are repeated because they're so important. This one's repeated because it's important. We want to be on guard. Now, the reference, Joy, that you made to trust in the Lord with all your heart is actually from Proverbs chapter 3. And it says, do not lean on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. The point there is, if you are going to live a profitable and wise life, live according to wisdom, because that's what Proverbs is about, then you can't just go on what you think is best. There's a place for that, but you have to be careful because of the deceitfulness of the heart that we know about in other passages, and that there's a way that seems right to a man, but his end is the way of death. We have to think about the Lord. And we have to take into consideration his perspective. Now, the way it puts it in the text is, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. It doesn't say don't use your own understanding, but your human understanding can't be the primary source when God speaks on something. And what's interesting is the next phrase is in parallel with the first phrase, and that is, in all your ways acknowledge him. In other words, the way that we trust in the Lord with all our heart is to acknowledge him in all our ways. We bring God into the decision-making process. We try to do things according to the way we understand what his word says. Now, all of these are things that will help us not be deceived by our deceptive heart. And that's why those exhortations are in Proverbs and other passages as well. Now, I want to say something about the word heart because I think there's a mistaken understanding here, and a lot of people make this mistake. I would be interested in seeing, Joy, the places where the heart in the scriptures is equated with the feelings. I actually don't see that. I think people make that equation, because in modern times, when we talk about the heart is the source, or I should say the locus of the feelings. What does your heart tell you? Okay, how is your heart doing today? All right, we're talking about how somebody's feeling or what their feelings are communicating to them. We're not talking about their mind. We're talking about their heart. So we make a distinction between the heart and mind there. But in the ancient days, the heart was not considered the locus of the feelings. That was the bowels. The bowels were the locus of the feelings. Where are your feelings at? They're in your bowels, in your stomach, like, so to speak. And I'm not surprised now I think about it, because sometimes when you have really, really strong feelings or fears or whatever, don't you feel it viscerally? That you feel it down in the lower part of your abdomen? That's kind of the locus that where the feeling actually is. You get scared, you feel it low. So biblically, the heart means something different. It doesn't mean the feelings. The heart is the center of the person. It's where all the feelings and the acts of will and understanding and everything come together. So that is, it's the center of the individual. Okay, it is the whole person. So when it says trust in the Lord with all your heart, we're to put our whole self into trusting in God. Not our emotions, that's not what it's saying. It's saying you trust with everything you've got. That's what it's saying. Now, when Jeremiah says the heart is desperately wicked, it's just identifying the fallen nature within humankind. We are. We're fallen. We're broken. We do crazy things for crazy reasons. And that's why we can't just trust our human understanding. We have to be instructed by God about the nature of reality. That in the New Testament is called renewing of your mind. Your minds are being renewed. And Paul says in Romans chapter 12, he says, therefore, let's see, how does he put it? Therefore, I can't remember the next line, but we are to, in light of what he's taught, we are to offer ourselves as a living sacrifice acceptable to God, in which is our spiritual service of worship, he says, so that we can prove or establish or demonstrate what the perfect will of God is, that is what is good and acceptable and perfect. So as we are being conformed to the image of Christ and we are taking the truth that God provides for us about the nature of reality and we're imbibing in it and it's instructing us, this makes us more capable of doing what is right and overcoming the deceitfulness of our hearts, which is why we're instructed in Proverbs to trust in the Lord with all of your hearts. Don't lean on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge Him. And when we do that, then we are much more capable of living according to the truth, and therefore having a more fulfilling, satisfying, and proper life before the Lord. Now, as for the LDS Church, of course, we know that their epistemology, in other words, the means by which they are knowing what is true, is largely subjective. Or let's just put it this way, there is a subjective bridge to what they claim to be objective revelation. They think the pearl of great price and the doctrine of covenants and the, there's three books there, Pearl of Great Price, Doctrine of Covenants, and I'll think of the other one in a minute, are revelations by God. And therefore, that's God's objective revelation in addition to the Bible. But how do we know that's true? Now there's a subjective test, and this is the problem, of course. There's a misapplication of a verse in James right at the beginning about getting wisdom, asking God for wisdom, and the way they interpret that is that when we want to know if a book is inspired or not, we ask God to give us a feeling. Now, that's not what James was talking about. But nevertheless, that's the way they apply it. And because they have a certain feeling, they call it The Burning of the Bosom. A Pearl of Great Price was the other book. They have a burning in the bosom. That is what validates, in their mind, the Book of Mormon as an inspired document from God. And then kind of, you know, by connection, the other two books that are in the Mormon canon, The Pearl of Great Price and The Doctrine of Covenants, Doctrine and Covenants, rather. And so, here you've got a group that is using subjective tests to find out what is true. That's a mistake, because now it's all relating to their feelings. And these are feelings that can mislead us very easily, which I think that's what's happening with the Mormon Church. And what's interesting is, though there is an objective attempt, an attempt at objective justification by citing the passage in James, even so, they're misapplying the passage in James. Consider it all joy, James says, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that it may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if anyone lacks wisdom, for what? In the context, for what? Lacks wisdom regarding persevering in trial, it seems to me, would be the natural way of taking that, because that's what that passage is about. Then we should ask God for the wisdom. We should ask God to help us to know how to persevere in the midst of the trials that we're facing. James is not offering a subjective litmus test for determining which literature, which books are actually God-inspired, but that's the way they apply it, and that's a huge mistake. So even though they attempt to make an objective, an application of an objective test from a biblical verse, they abuse it, they misuse it, and consequently, they are left simply with an unjustified subjective method of justifying those books, and it gets them in trouble. And it gets them in trouble because the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked, and this is why we can't lean on our own understanding, but we have to turn to God's Word and properly read it, understand it, and apply it in order to be protected from our own hearts, our own selves that are deeply broken. Hope that helps, Joy. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Thank you for being part of our show. Bye-bye now.